Dream job or nightmare? It's hard to know if a career that looks great on paper will actually lead you to the life you want to live. So welcome to Dream Job Cafe. I'm Larry Port. I'll be asking different professionals the questions you won't find anywhere else. So grab a coffee, settle in. This is Dream Job Cafe. Hi, everybody. I'm Larry Port with the Dream Job Cafe. And I'm really excited today because I have the first guest that's not immediately in my circle of contacts. I wanted to interview an information architect, and I stumbled across Emily Claflin. She's an information architect with The Understanding Group, which is an agency. Emily, welcome.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Right. So this is a pretty wild title for a job, and a lot of people don't know what this job is. I personally love this line of work. So can you tell us a little bit about what an information architect does?
Yeah, it is a very niche job. I didn't even know it existed before I kind of stumbled into it through, you know, other things that I had been doing and work in school. But the idea behind information architecture is that we live in a world today where we spend a lot of time in these places that are made of information instead of being a physical place. You know, we don't often walk into a post office anymore, right? We go to a website and print out a label to ship a package. And so it kind of was born from this analogy of we're used to thinking about the architecture of physical places. And now we live in these digital places that are made purely of information, right? And some visual cues. And the idea of information architecture is that, you know, my job as an information architect is to give structure to information and organize it in a way that it is useful to people, that it helps them accomplish the goals that they want to accomplish, that it makes the most important information the most important information that's the easiest to find and the easiest to use. Most of my work happens in the context of websites or intranets or apps or things like that. But really, the principles of information architecture can be applied, you know, anywhere there's information.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that's so exciting about this work, is because the amount of data that's in the world is just, you know, expanding exponentially. And it requires people that are information architects to help the rest of us make sense of it. I mean, at a very fundamental level, like one thing to think about, and this is not what you do per se, but just like how an infographic or something can boil down information and present it to somebody in a usable way. You know, when you think about how that reduces complexity, would you say a lot of it has to do with like reduction of complexity of all this complex stuff?
Yeah, I don't know if it's necessarily reduction of complexity, because there's some things where you can't make the complexity go away, right? Mm-hmm. If you're working with an enterprise company that operates in dozens of countries and has, you know, thousands or millions of employees, like you can't take that environment and just make it simple. That's not really feasible. So the overarching goal of information architecture is often to take really complex information environments and bring clarity to that situation, right? So some of that is, if I'm one person coming to this website, there might be huge swaths of information that just aren't relevant to me, right? So how do I organize that website in a way that when I come here as one kind of person with one particular goal, right, I'm able to find the information that's relevant to me and it doesn't get muddied up by everything else there that I don't care about, frankly, right?
That's interesting. So and the analogy between the physical world is like, all right, well, let's open up this cabinet. What's stored there? Let's open up this drawer. Let's keep things organized so we can find it easily or more readily available than we might need. Is that kind of the idea, the analogy of the title?
Yeah, we often use the analogy of, you know, physical spaces or different rooms in a house sometimes to describe. We use this term at the Understanding Group sometimes talking about there's like sense making and then this idea of place making. So how do I make an information space feel like a cohesive place? And how do I make one place feel different from another place, right? In a house, you might go from the kitchen to the living room. And even if it's an open floor plan, it's clear this is the kitchen area, this is the living room area, right? How can you kind of mimic that in a digital space so that someone understands, you know, maybe now I'm in the like the browsing portion of the website, right? But now I'm in the purchasing portion of the website, you know, use a really kind of cut and dry example.
But it's closely related because, you know, if I'm thinking about like the information architecture of like Facebook, then, you know, there's the information from the news feed that's coming at you. But then if you need to go and change your security settings, like I always do because I'm paranoid, then that has its own space and its own information. And if you've ever gone in there, it's very complicated. So they must be spending a lot of time figuring that out. How is it different? Because I have not had a user experience designer on yet, but a user experience designer oftentimes is the go-between, but like the human and what are these screens going to look like? And then they give the designs to the engineer. So What is, like, how do information architecture and user experience design fit together or not? Like, where's the delineation?
It's a very blurry line. I think I wasn't around when the internet, well, I was around, but I wasn't working as a professional when the internet, you know, kind of first came on the scene, like in the 90s and early 2000s. But information architecture kind of bubbled up around that time in the context that we think about it today. And then, you know, different people had different approaches to it and used different words. And this kind of umbrella of user experience is what kind of bubbled up and became the most popular.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different job titles that do very similar work. And so in some roles, I would say the line between what's information architecture, what is user experience gets pretty blurry. For me personally, I would say that user experience work, especially user experience design, often is more concerned with like the visual appearance of the site. It's more prototyping and putting together interfaces and, you know, what color is the call to action button, for example. You know, it's not all that simple. There's obviously more skill to it than that. But information architecture is more concerned with kind of behind the scenes. Like if an information architecture for a site is done well, hopefully you never notice it. Wow. It's kind of like the framing for a house. Mm-hmm. And then the UX design is like, how do we make this a comfortable place for people to spend time, right?
Well, so that's a great...
I personally wouldn't consider myself a designer. Like I am not, I have colleagues who started out as, you know, kind of graphic designers almost. And
but it
transitioned
speaks,
to information architecture.
But kind of speaks to the training, right? So like a lot of, one thing that I found interesting about information architects is that they came, a lot of the early ones, and I think maybe to this day, the curriculums have changed, but they come from library science, right?
Yeah. And I came from library science. So,
well, this is a great bridge then. So why don't you tell me about your background? So you're in high school, college, and you know, you have your interests. How did the career play out?
Yeah. I definitely was not someone who had a clear end goal in mind. Like I had classmates who said, I want to be a nurse or I want to be a lawyer. I never really had this idea of this is the thing that I want to do. But I was always a very good student. People were like, you're smart, you should go to college. And I essentially just chose what to study in college based on what I liked and was good at. So I ended up being a history and sociology double major with a Spanish minor for my undergrad. And, and then you graduate and you're like, what the heck do I do with that? There's no direct path to go be employed as a sociologist or a historian. And I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, but I had studied abroad when I was in college and really enjoyed it. And so I ended up doing a year of service with AmeriCorps right after I graduated, where I moved originally from Wisconsin. So I moved from Wisconsin to Central Texas, and I spent a year teaching English and GED classes for adults at a nonprofit learning center. And I kind of knew going into that, this probably isn't like a career that I will do forever. But I kind of went into it with the attitude of, I don't know what I want to do, but this is a really good way for me to have new experiences and get more information about the kind of things that I'm drawn to and that feel sustainable. So that was a 1 year engagement. I didn't want to stay in Texas. So I went back to Wisconsin and said, you know, there were parts of teaching that I really enjoyed. What's maybe similar to that, but something that's a little bit more stable where there's actually full-time jobs, because that tended to be very like part-time in the evenings or things of that nature. And that's how I found a job at the local public library system.
Oh.
So I applied for that. I did a kind of part-time entry-level position there for about a year where I was mostly just kind of like working the service desk, putting books back on the shelf, helping with people with computers, that sort of thing.
But you like books though, right? You're a big reader?
Yes.
Have you always just, this is something that's really interesting to me because I feel like there's people who are like English majors, sociology majors, liberal arts majors, and they don't know what to do, how to apply this kind of thing. And this is so great for it. But so go ahead, continue. You're at the library, right? Okay. And then what?
Yeah. So I started there part-time. I got promoted to a full-time position there after about a year. And I had just been hired in that role. And I remember I asked, before I got hired into that full-time role, I'd asked to meet with the deputy director who kind of did the hiring for the library system. And because I was like, at the time I was like 23 or whatever, you know, it's like, I have this job now, it's good now. It's obviously, I don't think going to carry me through till I retire. And
right.
So I kind of met with her and was like, this work is really interesting to me. I have hypothetically 40 years of my life left to work. What can I be doing now so that when it's 3 or 5 years from now and I'm ready for the next step that I'm prepared and not, oh, I'm bored of this role, but now I have to go, you know, get a degree or something before I can advance. And so I was at a point where if I wanted to go further in libraries, basically I needed a master's in library and information science. It's kind of just a technicality that you have to have.
Was that person that you spoke with, was it a mentor or was it like more just like, are you checking in with an HR professional or what was the relationship there?
Yeah, at the time I didn't know her well at all because I worked at most public library systems that have more than one location. There's like the central library where all of the like administrative staff work, and then there's branch locations. So I was at a branch. So I didn't know her well. I didn't see her really on a day-to-day basis. But I was like, you ultimately make the hiring decisions. And she's, yeah, if you ever want to talk about, you know, what it looks like to have a career in libraries, you know.
That was a really smart move. So she tells you to get a master's degree in library science. Are there a lot of programs or is it like hard to find?
There's quite a few. It's not super rare. It's not like an MBA where you can get one like
everywhere,
at any school on earth, but there's a good amount of them. So I ended up doing mine actually fully online. So I was working in a library full time and then doing my graduate program kind of like at night on the side.
Ooh, it sounds tough. That sounds exhausting.
It was. I am always doing too much. So it's just kind of my default mode. But yeah, so I was working at the library full time. And then I started my master's in fall of 2019. And then COVID happened and a lot of things changed kind of just like in my life and in the world and in public libraries. And it got to a point where I was like 75% of the way through my master's program. And I was just starting to see in a lot of different ways, it's like, I don't know if public libraries are going to be sustainable for me, like long-term over the course of my career, but I'm 75% done with this master's degree. Is there something else I can do with it? Because I've invested a lot of time and money in this and it would be nice to not just like finish it and then throw it in the garbage, you know, metaphorically. And so I was taking a class in information architecture there as part of my degree program. And my professor at the time worked at the company where I now work. And he kind of reached out to me and was like, hey, you seem like you really are interested in this. You seem to have kind of a natural aptitude for it. Would you ever be interested in doing an internship? Because the company where I work hires interns in the summers. And I was like, I was about to email you and say, how do you do this for a job? Because it seems like something I would really enjoy. And so I ended up having to choose between either staying at my library job or quitting to do the internship. And it was like, I'm never going to get an opportunity like this again. You know, it's like, it was definitely kind of a leap to be like, I'm going to quit my adult job with a pension and go be an intern for 3 months and then see what happens. But yeah, I did the internship and then really enjoyed it. And it, luckily for me, it worked out that they were in a position to be bringing on more staff at the time. So I ended up actually going from a 3 month internship to, I had one semester of my master's program left after my internship. So I kind of did they didn't call it a trial period, but it was like, we'll hire you part-time. Yes. You can work hourly while you finish school. It'll be nice for you because you'll have less demands on your time. It'll be nice for us because we'll get a feel for how you work as an actual employee, you know, with clients and things of that nature. And then I finished my graduate degree in December of 2021 and then started full-time in January of 2022.
It's such an awesome story. And there's a lot that I want to unpack just for like kids who are in school and young adults. Like when you talk to your professors, like all sorts of opportunities open up. When I was in grad school, I went to grad school for computer science and I would always routinely talk to my professors because I had no idea what the hell was going on in my classes. But this one professor invited me to start working with them. And then it became this research position and it paid for my grad school and it gave me a stipend and it was my first, you know, stop on the train, so to speak. And then, I mean, the other thing that really stands out is that you just do not know when opportunities are going to present themselves. And, you know, the trick is really that is everybody I talk to, they're doing their thing. They have this background, they're ready for the opportunity. And then all of a sudden something pops up and then they do it. And then, you know, they go on these trajectories and that seems to be how everybody's career plays out. So, you know, I think your story is, you know, a great example of that. So, if you get, can you tell me a little bit about what your first project was like? And no secrets, I don't want you to give away any company information, but just so people get a sense of what this work might be like.
Yeah, I think I won't go with my first project because it's not the most, I'll go with one, my first one that is more interesting to talk about.
Yeah, go with a juicy one, that's good.
Yeah, so the first project I worked on kind of extensively that was where I came in at the beginning of it because most of the things I worked on, it was like, this is already in progress and now you're going to jump in midstream when you get hired, right? So the first project that I worked on in this role where like I started the project from the beginning was a client that worked in kind of equipment manufacturing.
Okay.
Big, huge machines. And they were hoping to build a customer experience platform from scratch, where they had all these different kinds of people who work with the machines, essentially. So there's engineers, and then there's facility managers who, once it's installed, have to do maintenance on it. And there's, you know, dealerships where you buy the equipment, and there's, you know, so there's all these different roles. And the idea was to build this one centralized platform where, you know, everyone can go and find the information they need to operate, maintain, specify these machines, essentially. And so one piece of my job that can be its own role, like user experience research, can be, some people just have jobs as UX researchers and that's all they do. Information architecture, good research is kind of a prerequisite. If you don't know about the people who are using your information place and what they need and what they're looking for, yeah. You don't
know. What are you trying to do, right? Like that kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the first point was kind of trying to figure out, where are all of these people? Recruiting is always the hardest part of research, right? It's like, where do the technicians who go and replace the filters on these machines, like, where are they? They're not on LinkedIn waiting for you to send them a message and say, hey, do you want to talk to me on Zoom? Like, you know, so for a while, we were actually going in person to different trade shows. So we would go to a trade show for, you know, technicians or for facility managers in industries that use this type of equipment. And we would do interviews. We just ask them, what do you do? How does it relate to this kind of machinery? And we would come back, you know, with this wealth of insights. And then we would take that and start synthesizing it into different models, like you mentioned visual models earlier. I think a lot of what we do is trying to capture all of this complex information and then synthesize it into models that we can use so that everyone can look at a shared artifact and say, like, yes, this is, we're talking about the same thing and it's all captured here, right? So we would make models of, made one like big confusing one that showed all of the different kind of persona types, so engineers, facility managers, and then which parts of the life cycle of this machinery are they involved in, for example. So we could get a sense of, like, when is the dealer handing off a packet to the facility manager for the place that just bought this machine, or, you know, when did the technicians come in or the engineers? And then from there, eventually built out a structural, we call it a structural model, but it's basically saying, what are the different information spaces that need to exist in this platform? Right, if it's going to be effective for everyone.
So this is complex, very intellectually demanding work.
Yes, I agree.
So let me ask you this. I mean, this is a good time to ask this question. Who, like, does well in this type of role, and who would not do well in this type of role? What aptitudes and skills, you think, temperaments?
Yeah, I would say the three big things that come to mind for me are, one, I think this kind of work lends itself really well to people who are naturally curious. You have to have an appetite to, like, really get into the weeds of something and understand how it works in order to, you know, design a good information structure for the platform
you have to learn, like to gather information, that type of people.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely have to be curious and interested in kind of, like, just sucking a bunch of information into your brain, right? And letting it stew in there and make sense of it. I'd say another one is, we talk about being okay with ambiguity. This isn't kind of job where you go to work and you, like, follow the same process every day, or there's an ultimate correct answer that you're hoping to find, right? It's not, you know, like, even at points when I was working in the library, there's times where it's like people put a book on hold. You have to go find it on the shelf. You check it in. Then it says, this book is on hold for this person. You put it on a shelf, they come get it. Like, it's a step-by-step repeatable thing. There isn't a lot of that in this kind of work. Every website that you work on demands its own information structure. You don't want to recycle the information architecture, you know, from site to site, or use the same exact one as all of your competitors, because then you're all the same,
you're
right?
Not differentiated. Yeah. So, those things, so being good with ambiguity, being good with having the desire to consume information, anything else?
And I think I'd say maybe the best way I can describe it is, I think you also have to have an ability to be able to see kind of the forest and the trees at the same time. Like, you have to be able to look at all of the details, but then keep in mind, you know, what are the strategic objectives that we're trying to accomplish with our information architecture? What is this ultimately accomplishing for the organization who owns all of this information, right? Like, it's, I think at one point I used the analogy of, when I was a kid, we had this bucket of Legos, and it wasn't a kit where it's, oh, I build it. Now I made my Harry Potter like they have now. It was just a big bucket of loose bricks, right? And we dump it out on the floor and you try to build a house or whatever. In a lot of ways, that's kind of what my job is. Like you get a client and they're like, here's my bucket of information, right? And you have to dump it out and sort through all the pieces and say, you know, these are kind of the same, or here's the four kinds of things I'm starting to see, or, you know, and then I think the other thing that's really interesting with digital spaces compared to a physical product is that depending on how you present the information, you can make it so many different things. So
that's interesting.
You need to have a clear objective of what you want your information to accomplish for you in order to be successful in a lot of ways. And so you have to be able to hold that like kind of North Star strategic purpose of like, why does all this information exist? And then the like down in the weeds, sorting my Legos.
So what is this? You got to keep that sight.
Have to do with that?
Yeah. So you got to keep that vision and work towards it. And I would think that what you're describing there, like I would think that your training in history and sociology would be amazing because they throw so many texts at you and it's up to you to kind of like determine the through line through those things. I would think that would help.
Oh yeah. I mean, people always joke, you like, oh, you're a history major. You just memorize dates all day. I'm like, I don't know hardly any dates off the top of my head. Cause most of what you do as a history major is you get, you know, a topic from a course and then you have to develop a thesis. You have to say, here's something new I can extrapolate about what was happening in human history at this period of time. So you go collect all of your primary sources, right? And then you say, what am I picking up from all of these? It's interesting. I keep hearing this phrase or this thing, or people are referencing this idea.
And what is salient?
An argument. Yeah. And you support it with all of your primary sources. And so it is, there's a lot of similarities, I would say.
That's kind of cool. All right. So for those of you that are listening, the way that I found Emily, because she is, again, the first person that I like reached out to outside of my own circle, is because she is, I think, a co-chair of an information architecture conference, which yeah. is impressive because she's a very young professional. So she's already like in the mix. But as in your role, right, from what I understand, you get to help identify what is going to be on the programming for the conference. So maybe you could tell us a little bit about the trends that are happening in the industry and like where it might be in a couple of years with all the AI stuff that's happening.
Yeah. So part of my role as one of the conference chairs, the three chairs, we all have our own kind of lane. So one focuses more on marketing and communications, one focuses more on kind of operations. And my lane is kind of programming. So, you know, what are we going to talk about at the conference? How are we going to use our time? And one piece of that is selecting a theme for the conference. So our theme this year is navigating complexity.
I thought you were going to say like the 1950s or something.
No, we have heard people are really sick of the topic of everything being AI. So we are trying to find something that kind of encapsulated an evergreen challenge of our field without kind of pigeonholing us into one
right.
specific lane. Mm-hmm. I'd say AI is definitely still something that's top of mind for a lot of people. Kind of in two ways, it's like, how does AI affect the way that I sit down at my desk and do my work every day? That's one way that people are interested in talking about it. And another way that people are interested in talking about it is, how does AI transform the landscape I'm working in, right? I think there's a lot of opportunities for information architecture with AI, because if you want to, you know, build a chatbot that draws on your resources, the saying is kind of garbage in, garbage out, right? If you just point it to a big pile of files somewhere in SharePoint and say, you know,
go at it.
Like if it finds eight redundant versions of your policy, it doesn't know which one is correct. Or, you know, so if you want to build these kind of AI tools, especially for essentially information retrieval, like they're becoming a new way. It was always kind of search or browse. There's like search, browse, and now there's chat. Mm-hmm. So if you want to use those kind of interfaces and that kind of technology to facilitate people accessing information, whatever information you have on the back end has to be structured, right? It has to be organized. You have to tell the bot what information to be delivering and help it deliver, you know, the most accurate information that it can. So I think those two kind of flavors of how does AI impact our work are really top of mind for a lot of people. The question of ethics is also something that people are really, I think, interested in and worrying about, maybe, because, you know, there's a lot of ethical implications that come with the use of AI. And so there's a lot of different ways people want to talk about that. And then particularly in the submissions, we saw this year from our conference, our theme was navigating complexity. So I don't know if that kind of tilted the scales maybe at all, but we did get a lot of submissions from people wanting to talk about navigating organizational complexity. You know, it's what does it mean to work in a world where, you know, where our organizations are full of people who are all complex, you know, multidimensional gotcha. Beings with their own lives and different priorities and office politics and competing priorities and, you know, goals. And then oops, here comes AI. And then, you know, it's you know, oops, here comes some layoffs. And, you know, there's
well, that especially, kind of you know, since you're working with people to define what it is that they want to accomplish, a lot of people just change their minds constantly. And as yeah. As a software engineer, I can empathize because, you know what I mean? It's impossible to build a moving target. So I could see why that would be a big issue. Let me ask you this. If somebody was interested in information architecture, would this conference be something they might want to like spend a little money and check out?
Yeah, I would say it's a great resource for people. I actually, when I was deciding whether or not to do my internship, I think my professor slash colleague had recommended like, hey, the conference is happening. It's a great resource to check out. I got lucky because it was online that year because of the pandemic. So I could just kind of call in from my house. I didn't have to travel anywhere, but I don't know exact numbers off the top of my head, but I think I'd say close to half of the conference is first timers the last couple of years since we've been back in person after COVID. So there's always a lot of new faces. There's a lot of people, I would say more recently too, who might be a UX designer, for example, who are interested about information architecture and want to know, can I learn like some information architecture skills to incorporate into my practice, even if I'm not, you know, going to become an information architect necessarily. So I'd say it's definitely, there's a good breadth of topics, experience levels, roles that we cover at the conference. It'll be in person this year in Philadelphia. So cool. Yeah, if you're interested in learning more, I'd definitely check it out.
So what website do they go to if they're interested in this? What do they search for?
I think it's the iaconference.com, I believe.
Yeah, if you look
I up, go it, so often, it's like.
If you do a web search for internet or information architecture conference, it comes right up because that's how I found you.
Yeah.
So, well, listen, this was an excellent conversation. I think your career is like an awesome one to be in. I mean, if you think about just the epic scale of everything that's coming down the path of these data centers and all the energy requirements and just like how much stuff is being generated now, it's only going to become more and more important. And the level of strategic thinking and human interaction required means that it is not going to be automated out. It sounds like if anything, the AI is going to augment this career. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I had a conversation with someone a while ago. I think this was maybe over a year ago when like generative AI, ChatGPT were like first really kind of breaking into the mainstream. And I was like, you know, if my core skill set was just auditing websites, I'd probably be worried right now. But most of what makes me really good at my job is my ability to meet a group of six stakeholders who I have never met them before. I don't know anything about their organization, you know, talk to them, draw out from them, what is it that you actually want me to do for you and get them aligned and agree. And then, you know, synthesize all the information and navigate like the human element. I think a lot of my work. People think of, oh, information, you just put the words there, but the way we deliver information, the way we absorb information, what we do with the is all very human. And so I think, yeah, it's like articulating what is my strategy, what is the purpose of this information, and being able to really dig into that information on a systemic level, right? And say, what are the goals that this information needs to facilitate people accomplishing, and how do I set it up to do that? Yeah, like you said, it takes a lot of kind of strategic and abstract thinking that I don't think will be automated anytime soon.
Right, yeah, no. Well, Emily, thank you so much for your time today. I really do appreciate it. For those of you listening, give us a like, share it with your friends, and give us some feedback. If you have a career you want us to explore, we're happy to do it. And if you can, please be grateful for something today.